Today's program has been brought to you by Kane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit Kane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, everybody. It's Sunday. That means it's another edition of The Main Course. I'm your host, Patrick Martins. We are engineered by Joe Galarraga. Joe, wake up. That intro couldn't have been that bad that quick.
Not yet.
All right, so you're still up. How's it going? How was your performance last night at Webster Hall?
It was great. It was a blast. Very fun time. Played with a band from London, Ontario, Canada. So it was
great. And you were the lead singer for it?
Yeah, I was. Lead singer every time.
Very impressive. Yeah, you kind of have that build and kind of comport yourself a little like Mick Jagger. You have that Jagger swagger.
Oh my gosh, thank you, Patrick.
For sure. So, well, we want to thank Kane 5, of course, for sponsoring us. We absolutely love that wine here at Heritage, and Chris Howell has been a supporter of Slow Food back in the late 90s and early 2000s, and now Heritage Radio Network. He cares about the land. He cares about community. So we really appreciate Kane 5. Well, this has been a... Of course, we're broadcasting out of Roberta's, 261 Moore Street. This has been a big food week. There's been a lot of outrage in Europe because of horse meat being found in the... In lasagna and in hamburgers. They did a study and they found some horse meat. Well, one question I have is, you know, how come the business section publishes this and not the food section? I mean, they don't have a reporter that covers this. I mean, it is, that food section is such the style energy. I think they it is their duty to also report it, you know, to have their opinions on things, you know. Of course, it is weird to think that you might have been given horse meat when you think you're eating cow meat, but you know, what's the real difference? I mean, false labeling, that's an issue. And of course, there's this equine painkiller, which I'm going to mispronounce, but phenylbutazone or bute. They've already abbreviated it for, because it's hard to pronounce, just bute. Bute is a, could be very, very detrimental to human health. So that equine painkiller, if that got into the burgers, you have a serious shit show on your hands. If it didn't, it's not quite so bad. But and then also in the horse kind of zone, they just are about to open for the first time, I think in 6 years, a slaughterhouse for horses in the United States. And it's going to be in New Mexico. So that strikes me as a good idea because, you know, it seems like farmers should get something for, you know, ending the lives of their horses in a humane manner versus, you know, having no incentive at all to deal with the issue and then those horses die alone or starving in fields. So a few slaughterhouses is probably a good idea. Anyway, Joe, would you eat horse meat or have you ever eaten horse meat?
I never have, but I would.
You would?
Yeah.
That's cool. No, I think it's a very lean meat. People like it very much. And then in other news, before we get to our first guest, you know, which is a very, very respected chef in the industry, and we're honored that he came in and talked with us this Sunday, James Tracy. He's about to come on, and at 12:35, we're going to call Nancy Newsom, one of the most preeminent ham curers in the United States. But Fairway reopened, as did the Brooklyn Winery yesterday in Brooklyn. So that was really, really big. I live near Red Hook. Heritage Radio Network covered it. We had two of our interns out there reporting. And based off of their summary of what happened at Fairway, you know, it was really exuberant. I mean, the story begins and ends with the fact that Miss America was there. And we were very honored to get a few words from her. Anyway, congratulations to our corporate sponsors, Fairway Market, and to the revitalization of a really damaged neighborhood from Hurricane Sandy. So mazel tov, congratulations. And congratulations to you guys, Joe and Aaron Fairbanks, the executive director of Heritage Radio Network, and Jack Inslee, the producer. I think we're about to come on our 4,000th show and counting. You guys just published a new membership brochure. You got membership is soaring. You just started your monthly salon series. A really great turnout for the event. And anyway, you guys are doing great stuff. I'm a big admirer of your guys' energy and ideas. So we're going to take a 30-second break and come back with James Tracy of Kraft and Colicchio & Sons.
You're listening to Rabies by Huntronic on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. For more information, visit cane5.com.
Every Tuesday at 12 p.m., you can call food scientist Dave Arnold and ask any question you want.
John from Chicago, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave.
Cooking issues!
Who am I fooling? This is horrible stuff. Without glutamic acid, you die. It is a matter of taste, but there's a lot more fat in sausage than you think.
Get ahead of the curve. Tune into Cooking Issues every Tuesday at 12 p.m. on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right. Well, we are back in studio with Chef James Tracy. Welcome, James.
Thanks, Patrick.
Well, it's a real honor to have you in studio. You are, you know, it's an amazing bio to read. It's almost so impressive. I don't want to just read it because it's got so much information in it. I thought we would kind of do your bio as a kind of rapid fire, which is awesome, and it's my favorite part of all shows. So, you're very inspired by Green Market. That's just a huge thing, driving force for you back from your early days when you first got into food in Texas.
I wouldn't say Texas too much, but once I got up to New York, and then even when I was in Western Mass for a little while, dealing with the Green Market, but also small farmers and, you know, random people that you guys work with at Heritage, even, you know, with meats, you know, all sorts of vegetables, and, you know, building relationships on those, you know, you know, inspire. You know, you go out and you find a certain vegetable, and you figure out what dish you want to do with it, and go from there.
So, and now you work alongside with Chef Tom Colicchio at two restaurants. I mean, well, three really, but in New York City anyway, Colicchio & Sons and Kraft, which received its second three-star review from the New York Times in September of 2011. So, I mean, that is two very, very high-end restaurants and challenge restaurants, because I mean Kraft was one of these restaurants that really pushed the envelope of what a menu looks like. I mean, it really allows you to craft your meal as you wish. Can you explain a little bit the concept of the menu at Kraft?
Yeah, when it originally came out, you know, it'll be 12 years this month, actually. Everyone was so surprised and like, you know, what's going on with this menu? And, you know, you look at steakhouses and it's been done for a very long time, you know, mm-hmm. very similar menus. So that we're doing fish, you know, all sorts of great birds, you know, all sorts of different vegetables, mushrooms.
But you don't just have appetizers and main course and desserts. And with the cheese course, you have something like 10 categories or whatever.
Yeah, the categories are broken down into like roasted, raw, you know, mushrooms, grains. So, you know, you pick and choose. And, you know, the best part about it is that you pick and choose whatever you want. Mm-hmm. So people who are extremely picky, who don't like sauce on the side, or I don't like this garnish with this plate. This is like the perfect case scenario. You can choose exactly what you want, and it has very minimal garnish, and the sauces are, you know, very, you know, sometimes on the side are, you know, it's extremely well for picky people and also mm-hmm. for vegetarians.
And now, in Colicchio and Sons, you still have a very diverse menu, but you're essentially selecting a little bit more than you are at Kraft, because, you know, you can really make your own menu at Kraft. At Colicchio, it's a little bit the more traditional appetizer main course. So has that been a tough transition of what you would pick to represent you guys on the menu?
It's been a fun transition because I was at Kraft, you know, back at Kraft for 4 years. And then I talked to Tom about going over to Colicchio & Sons. So it was, you know, it's fun. You know, it's a different, like, plating food compared to, like, the family style that we do at Kraft. You get to play a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how you order and how you think about doing the food is a little bit different. You know, we have different tasting menus. We have the tap room, which has, you know, 20-something beers on tap, including Shift Drink, which is an awesome beer that we did for the just for our restaurant. Mm. But it's more casual in the front. You know, like, we'll do braised brisket with mashed potatoes and pickled, you know, pickled cabbage. And then the back, we'll have a 7-course menu that is a little more complex. Mm-hmm. You know, truffles and caviar and, you know, all those type of things that you think of.
Very interesting. Now, I see you're a graduate early on now, throwing it back a little bit, the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park. Did you learn more from your school time or more from actually being in kitchens and working with chefs? I mean, just what's your stance on paying money to go to school to learn about cooking?
Well, at that point, I was 18 when I went to the CIA. You know, a lot of people are career changers or go later in life or whatever. So it was good for me to go to some sort of college. Looking back, I would have rather gone to like a 4-year program, maybe got a bachelor's in something else, mm-hmm. and then went to CIA or even started cooking at that point. So for me, it kind of grounded me into the point where I was going to go afterwards. You know, my learning curve was great at the beginning of certain things, you know. I went to Red Sage for a little while right out of school.
In Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I moved to D.C. after school and went to Red Sage and hung out with some people. And Chris Constantino, had a great time hanging out with him.
Who now has gone out west, right? San Francisco.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He's on television. I see him. And he is uses all those off cuts.
Yeah, great guy. A lot of passion. And, you know, when I was 20 and we were all going out having a good time, you know, a lot of trouble, but it was fun. And then I went to Vidalia and worked for Jeffrey Boubin, and mm-hmm. we had a great team when I went in there. And
what did you learn there? I mean, what did you take away?
I think I learned the most, you know, in a small period of time through Jeff, because I was just turned 21, you know, like I was kind of a sponge. So, you know, one, that kitchen was extremely rough to come into. Like, we never asked anyone's name until after 2 weeks they were there, because it seemed like there was no point, for better or for worse. But I learned his work ethic. You know, he's extremely tight. You know, he's a chef owner. So he's the guy who goes to the garbage and picks out the silverware and then goes and, you know, talks to the staff severely. But also, like, learning basic techniques of sauce, cooking protein, vegetables, you know, that was a great starting point.
Is it harder to be a sponge? Are you less absorbing now in your older age? Like, it's hard to teach an old dog new tricks. I mean, now are you kind of set in how you see things?
No,
or do you still absorb as much as quickly as you did then?
Yeah, I feel like I absorb the same. I just, there was more to absorb as a cook at mm-hmm. that point.
Right.
You know, I was young, I was, you know, dealing with cooks now, I try to think about where I was at that point and, you know, instill like qualities like I learned when I met Jeff. Mm-hmm. And he's the reason why I went to New York to start cooking.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because you left D.C. You followed in the footsteps of, God, what is that famous name? Who's that famous chef in D.C. from the 70s and 80s? Number one chef of all time, anyway.
Paladin,
yeah, Jean-Louis Paladin.
I try to get a job there.
Oh, yeah?
It was an awesome kitchen, and I have a menu from that point, and you know, I think I was American and I was very young.
So. He wished he had gone to New York, it seems.
Well, he did at the end.
Oh, at the end. Yeah, yeah. But it was funny because he was such a pioneer. And then he's like, which city do I go to? And at the time, D.C. seemed better than New York. But then you landed at Danny Meyer's Gramercy Tavern. And that's where you first met Tom Colicchio, right? Is in the kitchens there at Gramercy Tavern.
Yep. I was cooked there for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. kind of worked everywhere in the kitchen. Even worked pastry for almost a year with Claudia, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. It was myself and Benno working pastry.
Jonathan Benno? Yeah, really? He was on pastry?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I had to carry him on pastry.
And now he's at Per Se, and then he went to Lincoln, right?
Yeah, he's at Lincoln, yeah.
Well, very, very interesting. So you and Tom must have had some type of connection there. But then you moved on and worked at L'Espinasse, the St. Regis Hotel, which is a 4-star rated restaurant.
Yes, that was great because it was a point where, you know, a lot of these classic French restaurants were closing, and working for Delouvier was pretty amazing in a tough situation with the union, and you know, at a certain point they closed, but you know, I got to saw some amazing stuff. You know, how he dealt with hair. You know, the wild Scottish hare, the poached poulard, that was one of his signature dishes. And, you know, it was a great experience.
So what's that mean, a signature dish? Yeah, I mean, did he just do that dish better than anyone, or did no one else do it?
I've never seen anyone do it like that.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe it?
It was stuffed with foie gras, and we made a stock that was three times over with whole hens. So, you get the hens in the stock, you take the hens out.
So, not just the bones.
No, the old hens.
Old hens, yeah.
And then you do that three times over, which is not very cost effective.
but it is delicious.
Made an incredible stock. You had a little tomato in it, and then we would poach the poulard in there, and then they would show that and serve that for two, and then made a basmati truffle risotto. And the risotto there was, you know, it was kind of like a butter sauce, you had to be careful not to break it because there was so much butter added to it.
Very interesting. But so why didn't you stay at Gramercy Tavern then? I mean, you just had reached as high as you were going to go there, and you just wanted to still see other cuisines and work
absolutely.
Under other
absolutely,
people.
Absolutely, yeah. It was a chance to go see a 4-star French, classic French technique restaurant. And, you know, it was great.
So how did you interact with Tom there? Did Tom say one day, hey, we should work together again one day? Or did you keep in touch with them as you went through these other chapters?
Well, at Gramercy, you know, I love working at Gramercy, of course, and working with the guys like Marco Canora and Jonathan Benno and Akhtar Nawab and, you know, Karen Damasco, I got to know. And, you know, so that was the opening crew at Kraft with, you know, Damon Wise and myself. And it was like, at a certain point in L'Espinasse, I was, you know, at one point I was sent over to the hotel kitchen because I got laid off for a couple months. And then I went back to the L'Espinasse because of, you know, logistics and the mess with the union. So I felt like it wasn't going to go anywhere there. And I felt like Kraft was a great opportunity. So I reached out to Tom and we had a 5-minute conversation on the phone and then we started. So
very good. And so you went to Kraft and you took on... Well, you helped them open it.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Those lights up there, we spent about 8 hours one day putting those lights pictures together. Because it was a little late opening, so we had to fill our time.
So did you have a bigger kitchen because you had so many dishes that you had to keep fresh and fire at the right times? Because, you know, basically it was like a tasting menu, except that the person can choose what they want.
Well, there's a lot. When the plates come up to the table, it's all set in the middle. So there's a lot of plates to go up. A 7-top, the ticket could be, you know, a foot and a half long because all the sides and all the garden, you know, everything that's involved. So, I mean, I think being a chef-owned restaurant, you know, the chef was always very conscious of the kitchen, you know, so we had a great kitchen.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So are you nervous or is it a different kind of clientele than the other restaurants? Because Tom Cook is a top chef and it's a top chef restaurant. I mean, is that pressure to dazzle and sparkle? Or, I mean, is that just a kind of funny thing in the background that the guy you work with and close to is just on TV? And
well, I mean, it's definitely not a hurt to the business. You know, I think any chef in the city that works in any restaurant is going to have pressure. It's a very similar pressure. The thing that, you know, you get comment cards and you get open table feedback and you get all this stuff. And you know, the thing that's really annoying is like when they make comments about Top Chef, like, you know, like, you know, Tom Click, you'll go pack your knives. You know, our dinner's really sucks. You know, well, that's kind of annoying. And, I'm sure that annoys the hell out of Tom.
Yeah.
But, I feel like we don't get that many comments anymore, but you see that every once in a while, and it's like, really, that was fucking original, you know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So now, managing two places is difficult. I mean, you have two different teams, two setups, two kitchens, and how you set up the kitchen and where things are placed. I mean, then all the personalities. I mean, do you run both in the same way, or does each restaurant require a different managerial strategy on your part?
Well, all the restaurants that are run a little differently, because especially Kraft and Colicchio and Sons, because it's a different menu. So the line staff is different. You know, the front of the house staff, there's more front of the house probably at Colicchio and Sons than Kraft. You know, there is, because it's more, you know, plated. Kraft is like bring a huge tray up and drop it, and then everyone, you know, puts all the platters in the middle of the table. So service is a lot different. But, yeah, definitely it's like same concepts, same cooking techniques, same thoughts about products, you know, like dealing with stuff with, we get from you guys, plus there's a multitude of different vendors.
Yeah, how many purveyors do you guys use between the two, three places now? We're going to talk about Topping Rose and the Hamptons in a couple of minutes.
Yeah, it's hundreds.
Hundreds.
You know? Yeah, there's very specific people, you know, like your pork we get from you.
Yeah, thanks for that.
The Hearts of Palm from some guy in Hawaii.
Oh, God.
You know, bacon from other person, and then, you know, just random stuff that, you know, is very specific. Like for years, we've done with Anson Mills, you know, all the different types of products.
Anson Mills being one of the heritage heirloom grain
yeah.
for polenta, right?
Yeah, they do a special grind for us at Kraft.
Oh, okay.
It's a little bit coarser, yellow. And then they have that Pearl Bianca, which you can get every once in a while, which is the white, really sweet polenta, which is amazing. Plus a multitude of other stuff they have.
So how would you say, how much of the ingredient is it? How much is it ingredient, and how much is it what you do to it? I mean, I know Alice Waters is probably on one extreme. She says 90% of cooking is agriculture. You know, other restaurants, like Wiley Dufresne, his whole thing is to break the food down all the way. So where would you put, you know, in the spectrum, Kraft and Colicchio and Sons?
Well, yeah, definitely it's the product, you know, it's heavy, I would say 80% product, you know, I mean, it could vary depending on who's handling it. You know, we could get a great product and have a cook just kill it, you know, but, when you get a great product, there's less manipulation that you have to do to it. you know, certain fish, you know, if you know how to handle all this variety of fish, you have a beautiful fish come in, it's very little that has to be done to it.
But is there a shortage? Like, could you say that you actually have the best of something because it's in such short supply? Or are these pristine ingredients generally shared now by all the great restaurants? Or do you actually have access to a fish that is just so delicious? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, are ingredients readily available now equally to all these great chefs? Or do you still have inside trading with certain producers because... Yeah. The slow food movement maybe isn't as big as we think it is on the farms.
Well, it's a constant looking at new products, meeting with new people, and trying out new stuff. Like in Topping Rose, we have someone who does raises striped bass, farm raised striped bass, but they're from a wild fish. So they get the eggs and then raise the fish from, you know, from scratch. But it's a wild. It's not a genetically enhanced, you know, striped bass that you get like down in Chinatown.
Right.
So then they feed them natural food, like squid chopped up from the boats, and then they put them in pens that are in the wild where the bait comes through the pens and they eat natural fish. So they started using...
So it's aqua, it's wild and cultured at the same time.
Yes. And it's, you know, I've seen the product and I haven't actually tried it, but they started using them recently. It's not, it's like the best of both worlds, I think.
I'm actually waiting for a chef like you to commission a diving team to fish a hunt a giant squid in the depths of the ocean and bring it back. I wonder if it would taste like squid does.
Yeah, it'd probably be pretty chewy.
But you talk about topping rows in the Hamptons. I mean, you just told me about that. That sounds insane. I mean, a 22-room inn and spa and restaurant. Now, the inn and spa are going to open in a bit, but the restaurant's already open. Has that? What's that been like, opening? Because the food is not that great in the Hamptons, surprisingly. The raw ingredients are, but it's not like there's 100 great restaurants out there. And so you're about to change that. What's it been like? Tell us about that place.
So it's been the works for a while. It's a renovated home and barn. And the house, you know, has 7 rooms in it. And is a, I can't remember how many seats, but it's like it's a small restaurant, like 60 seats or so. In September, we opened up just the restaurant itself, and it's a beautiful space. I mean, it's an amazing space. It's right off of 27 in Bridgehampton, and you go. And I was out there in the summer, you know, help opening it up, and you know, getting the team together with you know Ty, the chef's cuisine, and you know Tom and everyone. You know, it's so close to the city, it's 2.5 hours away, but, you know, everywhere there's, like, the most amazing lettuces and, you know, the most amazing corn and tomatoes, and it's so close, and you think, oh, yeah, the Green Market tomatoes are great, but out there there's such a, it's everywhere, and it's, you know, it's so much better.
Mm-hmm. It just tastes better.
It's just better. And
that's a terroir thing, or the ocean effect?
I think it's because it's right there, you know, like, we'll get it, like, a day later.
Uh-huh, right.
You know, and they get it like instantly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ty has worked with, you know, lots of smaller people with like beautiful lettuces and different, very small, different things from random farmers that, you know, don't necessarily we see, but because I'll go out there and go through the walk-in and be, oh, where'd you get that? Or where'd you get that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Plus the farm out there, we have a really cool guy named Jeff that, is, you know, since it was so late in the year last year, we had very little on the farm. But it's about 3/4 acre, and but the carrots that were coming out of the ground were just, you know, amazing, and you know all the lettuces that he got down because it was kind of quicker crops.
How many seats is that restaurant out there?
I think it's 60
seats,
somewhere around there, and then it has a barn that's kind of special parties, and you know.
Once that inn opens up, it'll be lovely. You just stay at the inn and eat the food. And
yeah, you don't have to drive anywhere. It's cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, so you're in all these three places. It's a very awesome for an ADD person. It'd be the ideal job because you're constantly doing something else. But what is a day in the life of how do you divide up your day? Are you waking up at 7 a.m. and trying to hit all three places every day, or... Well, how do you divide up your time? And also, with that same vein, how much time are you in the back of the house thinking about food costs, and how much of the time are you in the kitchen producing stuff?
Well, I wake up usually around 6:30 in the morning, and you know I have two kids, so I usually make breakfast.
We're out in Roberta's right
now.
Yeah,
they just had some pizza out here. They look a little squirrely, but that's fine. They can run around. So about 6:30 in the morning, get up, make breakfast, make their lunches, get them off of school. You know.
Cook for them too, huh?
Well, it's early in the morning, and I'm not usually that coherent, so it's very minimal cooking. But get them off of school, and then you know around 9 o'clock, I start getting emails. You know, some try to answer people's questions by email or whatever, and you know, depending on the day. Like the other day, I was in around 8:30, and we did a photo shoot for someone, and that just did, you know, it was all day. So my days change up depending on what's around. Like the other day, I was out in California for the week, you know, hanging out in L.A., Craft L.A., and then doing a special luncheon with the Bill Clinton Foundation.
Wow.
I think it was Bill Clinton. Yeah, it was for Bill Clinton, some other.
He's helping somebody somehow.
Yeah, he's doing something, you know, and I'm just cooking it.
Yeah.
So,
you're just helping them raise all the money.
Yeah, something like that.
Because, you know, people want to eat good food if they go to these fundraisers.
Yeah, and it was freezing, and it was a lunch out there in, like, Palm Springs area. So usually I try to get into Craft, Colicchio & Sons, or wherever I am, around noonish, somewhere out there. And then check out, you know, usually work with the chef cuisines and the restaurants and look at what's coming in, or, you know, talk to the purveyors, and, you know, that's when we're dealing, you know, throughout the day. I just got an email from some guy that gave me a sample of Wagyu the other day, a couple months ago. I was like, hey, what's up? And got to get back to him later. But so that happens throughout the day, you know. Get in, go through the walk-ins with wherever I am, and, you know, work with the chef cuisine and talk about, you know, recently there's been a lot about costing and, you know, how to organize it and how to everything evolve with it. We'll talk about the menu for the night, you know.
Which changes.
Yep. Changes, you know, well, everywhere it kind of changes randomly, depending on ingredients, you know, fish, meat, or whatever. Craft is really easy like that because, you know, it's all like, you know, I get the ruined duck in, I get 40 orders, and I run that out, and I go into something else.
Right.
So it's really easy to, like, change the menu up. And, you know, like the ruined duck is something in the past 5 years I've worked with a farm out in Jersey, and she raises them for us. And
heritage breed, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's very difficult to raise them, one, and it's very difficult to get the breed, you know.
Actually, to be a pure breed.
To be a pure breed, because, yeah, you know, it's been a very difficult situation, you know. The people that I've worked with in that, you know, when we get them, they're amazing.
Yeah.
But it's very random, and that's why Kraft is good at that, because we can get them up, get them on, and then just take them off.
No stress with the 86ing of anything.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I want to ask you about, before we get into some other interesting things, like I know you're very excited that Fairway opened.
Yes. So
we'll get to that in a second. I know you're going to go there. I want to know what you're going to buy. But just as we move on, I want to talk also about Laurie's Silver Bush's movie about hunger. How do you and Tom engage then? Because that's interesting to see how you do so many different things for him. You're constantly going around, purveyors, chefs, walk-ins, menus, cooking. How do you and him engage? Do you speak once a day, or when you want to change it up, what do you run by him and what don't you? And likewise with your sous chefs, how do they get their creative input in?
So when I go to the restaurants, Kraft, Click, and Sons, whatever, so I work with the chef cuisines. Luke is the chef cuisine at Click, and Sons, and Chris Levy is at Kraft, and Ty is at Top and Rose. Mm-hmm. So I try to work with these guys in all aspects of the restaurant, you know, ordering, mm-hmm. you know, who to hire, who not to hire, firing, or whatever. So I work directly with those guys and try to give them the information to do their job as well as possible.
Do you ever just show up in the middle of a shift and be like, hey, guys?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. You know, like a lot of nights I'll start at Click, and Sons, mm-hmm. and maybe expedite service a little bit, and then go over and just roll in the Kraft. Mm-hmm. You know, it's usually fine. You know, sometimes the cooks get a little excited, but, you know, whatever. So I try to give those guys information to do their job correctly. So if I'm leaving the kitchen, they can do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I've known Tom and worked with Tom, you know, since, you know, 97, mm-hmm. off and on. The reason why I've worked for that long with him, because, you know, I really like working for him and the company, and I respect what he does, and, you know, the food that we put out every day, I feel good about it.
And he just lets you be. I mean, he trusts you now, and you pretty much just run his restaurants for him, basically.
Well, I mean, he comes in and gives input, you know, like, you know, we're working on trying to make our menus as clean as possible, you know, with, like, the meats and everything. You know, if something he doesn't like, he'll say, hopefully, and, you know, then we'll change it, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something, like, I have an idea about or whatever, I can run by him. But hopefully, hopefully you trust me. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would think after all this time. So now his wife has just produced a movie or made a movie called A Place at the Table, Laurie Silverbush, and it covers the issue of hunger in our time. So can you speak a little bit about all this hoopla about this big movie? It sounds like a very important one.
Yeah, it's a pretty incredible movie. I saw it about a week and a half ago. You know, it's a documentary, and it talks about, you know, shows a lot of different families and a lot of a lot of numbers
here in America.
Yeah, it's about hunger in America.
Wow.
And shows through the years of, like, what has changed, what has not, you know, through programs and help and everything involved.
Is there still hunger in the U.S.?
There's a massive amount of hunger, and it's something, you know, I was very surprised about after watching the movie, is like how much hunger there is and the numbers and, you know, of people who are needing help and, you know, what's being done. Because, you know, we do fundraising and, you know, special events for hunger and children and food issues all the time. But, you know, it's amazing, and it kind of opens your eyes after you watch the movie, of like how much it's kind of, you know, it's just not out there in the news. It's surprising that it's not so much. It's not in the news.
Unbelievable. Yeah, that's another thing the food section doesn't cover. You know, there are certain issues that just never get covered. Global warming, you know, pesticides, lack of slaughterhouses, hunger. I mean, just on and on and on. These food magazines. And basically, I think every food, anything, television especially, you know, other than this radio network, they will build their entire content off of food.
Yes.
But not cover the 50 most important issues about food. I mean, it just seems a little, not that they need to change the entire scope of what they do, but 1%, 2% of their content could deal with some of these issues. I mean, that's amazing to know that all these...
Yeah, it's like, one, maybe they don't want people to know as much, and maybe people don't want to hear it.
Sponsors, I'm sure.
Yeah, you know, it's a, you know, after watching the movie, you know, it's an amazing movie. But... It's pretty eye-opening.
Yeah, so sure.
I would suggest everyone check it out.
Yeah, for sure. And we're going to tag it up on the site, A Place at the Table, Laurie Silverbush. But now in more local news, there's a you've kind of been you have an opinion, a firm opinion, about the bus strike, which has hit New York City. So could you explain to our listeners who are not from here exactly what the strike is and what's your take on it?
Well, the strike just finished. The busing system in New York, you know, went on strike because the union was like, there's arguments about how much you're going to get paid. And, you know, I think, I don't know all the facts. The main thing is that these people went on strike. Whoever's fault it is, the union or, you know, Bloomberg's department. Yeah. these are kids who, a lot of them are special need kids who rely on going to school to, like, speak, write, you know, the basic fundamentals of, you know, how you live. And it was ridiculous to me that the fact that these kids could not get to school to get, you know, this stuff. And it was for weeks. I think it was like 6 weeks. I'm not sure exactly. But like my daughter, luckily we were able to get her to school. But I'm sure there were lots of parents that weren't able to get their kids to school. And
building up all this knowledge base just to see it crumble.
Yeah, and, you know, it's like, these buses are transporting kids who need to go to school to learn how to read, you know, do fundamental things like, you know, use the restroom and, you know, to get through life. And, you know, these two, you know, the New York government and also the union of, you know, the school board union or the school bus union, you know, it seems so mundane that, you know, like maybe you guys should try to figure it out besides like, making sure, you know, get the kids to school, talk about it on the side, and figure it out.
Yeah, still keep those kids going, for sure. Well, it's over now, so now back. Is it the same guys, or is it?
I think for now it is. I think, after Bloomberg leaves, it'll be an issue for the next, you know, mayor, but...
Colin Quinn, or what, Quinn, whatever her name is.
Whoever decides to take that on.
Well, very interesting, and Fairway, you're happy to hear that Fairway is reopened.
Yes, yes, you know... That's where I usually go grocery shopping for, I live over in Carroll Gardens, so it's a short, you know, hop over there, and it's been tough the last couple weeks, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, that was so sad. They lost everything, all that food out to get thrown out, they were closed for months. I mean, Red Hook got it bad. I mean, my wife's sitting right out there at Roberta's, her cheese cave, you know, got flooded. The entire 20-foot refrigerator got lifted up off the ground. I mean, real powerful, even though, you know, many people in the city were like, "What? I didn't see anything."
Yeah, I mean, we got crushed by you know, crap.
You're right by the water.
Yeah, I mean, all our restaurants, you know, Clicky O'Sons, Craft Bar, you know, we were closed for a week, you know, and
We had 10 pallets of pork sitting at Pat La Frida with nowhere to go because 80% of our restaurants were closed.
It's a week or more. It sucked cleaning out that after that one.
Ooh, God, I heard some. It was a shit show.
Yeah, it was.
But anyway, this has been fascinating. I mean, there were all these other questions I didn't even get to ask, but it has been fascinating to get a lens into such iconic and successful restaurants. So thanks so much for being on. And craft.com, craftrestaurant.com, right? Is that the two websites?
Yeah, we have a website, craft restaurants. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but you know, I'm sure you Google
you
it and get
Google
on there.
It.
Yeah, yeah.
People can find
and
it
has
out.
Like you know, all the different restaurants that we have.
Well, from one hero of mine to another, we are about to call in to Nancy Newsom. Hey, Joe, did you have any luck getting Nancy on?
I'm going to give her a call right now.
All right, fantastic. Well, do you know, have you ever tried Nancy Newsom's ham, James?
Not that I know of.
She is a descendant of Colonel Bill Newsom, and when he passed away, she basically ran what is considered the most delicious ham, you know, or cured ham, like prosciutto-style ham made in America. So, and she's got a great style. She's actually won good food awards and this and that because of the consistency and pure deliciousness. And everyone's always like, oh, you got to go to Italy to taste this cured meats. But this woman has been doing it all along for over a century. She's in line with Sam Edwards and Al Benton. You know, she's part of the elite. So, Nancy, are you with us?
Nope, we're still trying to get her on the line here, Patrick.
Still trying to get her on the line. All right.
Yeah, I'd definitely like to eat some pork, so, you know, hopefully yeah. She brings some by later, maybe.
Yeah, I hope she'll come in from Kentucky. Well, I like her. She orders a few pallets from us every single year, and she's like, this is my high-end line. She has a little shop out there in Kentucky, and I really want to ask her about the water because the Sam Edwards laments that he doesn't have that same water base as the foundation for his properties where he cures the ham because he says it instills her hams with a delicious flavor just like you know bagels they say I guess are made good because of the water.
Yeah, well, New York water is good. So
well, we will take a quick break and come back with Nancy Newsom.
It's what gonna do. Pick up the refuse of DJ music, pitching tents under the guise of a mutual pact of innocence. For that persona, a 16-year-old
wants. Hey, Nancy, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine, Patrick. How are you doing?
Oh, very, very good. Thank you so much for giving us a little piece of your Sunday. Well, I want to, of course, say what a hero you are of mine and that you're going to be on my show many more times this year. You know, a
Thank
little
you.
Bit of each, a little bit of Nancy all the time. But tell our listeners who don't know you the headlines of the history of Newsom Hams.
My family came to America from England in 1632, and they learned the art of curing hams in Jamestown, Virginia. Then they traveled through North Carolina, Surrey County areas in Virginia, all the way into North Carolina, and wound up in and took this process with them. They began to cure the hams, which I feel like was by way of the Indians curing venison before the pigs arrived. And then it went through North Carolina. We moved there. And then after moving to North Carolina, our family, the Newsoms, N-E-W-S-O-M, as it is, stayed there. And then they finally made their way to Caldwell County in Kentucky, which is the county that I cure in 1823. So my family has always cured hams, and my father cured hams with his father, and my grandfather began a business in 1917 and cured steel for his family, and then my father actually saw the need when many people quit curing their own hams to actually continue to cure his own until it, in 1975, James Beard wrote about us in a syndicated column of American Airline magazine, and thus our mail order was born.
Hmm.
So, and then I'm curing today the same recipe that my father cured, which he verified by an old will from the 1700s.
Fantastic. Well, you got no stories older than that? Nothing, just 1632, that's it? No, just kidding. But let me ask you...
That's you, Patrick. You're always teasing with me.
Well, Nancy, tell me this. Is the locale an important place? Like, do you think the recipe is at all dependent on the place where you made it? Like, did the ham taste a little bit each place? Or do you think it's more the process? Or is it the water or the temperature or seasons?
I would say it has a lot to do with the seasons, because I know there are certain areas of the United States that, you know, the weather does not coordinate. Now, many commercial producers today that cure large numbers use climate control year-round. But what we do is we coordinate with the weather and with nature. And so, see, we're on, we have a cold part of the year in which it makes it very conducive. Of course, I would say that also the curing process itself has something to do with it. Plus, when we brought the hams into the government facility that we were, had to build 50 years ago, we brought the moles from a smokehouse that had always exclusively been a smokehouse since the early 1800s. Hmm. So these moles also came along with it. But we are on the same latitude as Spain. Our area in Princeton, where I cure the hams, has a network of caves underneath it, very same as over in Aracena, Spain, where my ham is in a museum over there.
Nice.
Yeah, so, I mean, it has a lot to do with the weather. It has a lot to do with the environment around the smokehouse, because just after, even after the curing process, when you put those hams into the smokehouse, as my father used to say, each smokehouse has its own moles. And so I would say that, you know, there are folks that blindfolded can select my ham. I know Mr. Peter Kaminsky can, was blindfolded at the Jacob Javits Center, and out of 12 hams, he chose mine. So I would say that a lot of that has to do with many of the things I just mentioned.
Well, is there a very, very, very interesting, is there a taste? I always ask people, and actually Peter Kaminsky was one of the best people to answer this question. You know, people have trouble putting taste into words. So what is the taste that you are trying to achieve consistently with your longer aged hams?
The taste has to do with a more of a, it has more of a pungent, it has a more depth of flavor in the aged hams. It is kind of hard to describe the flavor, but if a person tastes a younger ham and they taste an older ham, they definitely know the difference. It just has a complexity of flavors that go with it. I would say it's not just a salt flavor that they get. It's not just a pork flavor that they get. They get actually a complexity of a little salt, maybe just a little bit of sugar come through, and just an aged flavor. If anyone has eaten European hams, then they know the flavor that I'm speaking of.
Now, have you perfected it, and can you nail it every time, or is there still... would you consider yourself an expert at this point, or are there still, let's say, charming inconsistencies between the hams?
Well, I would say that there is no... I wouldn't consider myself an expert, because when we've arrived, then we always can learn more. But I would say that the curing process that we have has been, was perfected by my father. I saw no reason to change that. a lot of times when younger generations take on a business, they say, oh, I can do it better, or I can do it this way. But I have felt that the curing the hams the same way has actually, it's proven to be kind of an enigma in the marketplace, because of so many hams that are not premium aged by the weather anymore. And like I said, I think that our weather has a lot to do with it, and I think that the curing process that, that my father said about was, you know, is what makes it different, like I said.
Do you have brothers and sisters who carry the tradition with you?
No, my brother lives in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. He just retired from EPA and administration there, and he was there for 43 years with the government. But of course, he cured the hams with my father as a young boy. Mm-hmm. He cured hams with him. But he went on to get his college degree, which was very much what my father really wanted him to do. And my father really never expected me to take over this business. I don't know that he ever thought that his daughter would be the one to take it over.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're filled with many surprises, Nancy. What is your website?
My website is Newsoms, Newsoms, countryham at yahoo.com.
Right, that's the email. Right, so Nancy, you know, Newsoms, and it is very, very, very delicious. I almost think there's a kind of milky dairy flavor a little bit to the hams. I mean, they are one of a kind, and we're so honored that you buy our hams and that you exist and that you're out there traveling, promoting slow food, you know, through the hams. So will you come back on with us in 4 or 5 weeks, and we'll ask you some different questions about Newsom hams?
I would love to, and I would absolutely love to, and I might add they are nitrate-free, which makes for a very long hand-rubbing process with them, too. But I would love to come on. I am honored that you all appreciate. It's always an honor for a ham producer to have someone appreciate what they do, and you all work so exquisitely with me, and I just appreciate it very, very much.
Oh, you're very, very sweet. Well, in fact, now you can come on every week after that. That's pretty
well,
awesome.
Well, I would love to, Patrick. I'd love to talk to you every day.
I know. It would be very nice. I would never get anything done because I talk so much with you. It's just fun to talk. But thank you very much. And thanks to all our listeners for listening. Stay tuned for Straight No Chaser, followed by the Mike and Judy Show with Mike Edison and Judy McGuire. We'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.